Done very well. And I imagine you're quite scared, but you can relax now. The grown-ups are here. The underground passage turned out to be quite long. Robin lost track of how far they walked. It had to be nearly a mile. He wondered how vast the network was. Now and then, they passed a split in the tunnel, or a door embedded in the wall, suggesting more hidden entrances across the university, but Anthony shepherded them along without comment. These were, Robin assumed, among Hermes's many secrets. At last, the passage narrowed again, until there was only space to walk in single file. Anthony took the lead, holding the candle high above his head like a beacon. Letty followed just behind him.
"Why you?" she asked quietly.
Robin couldn't tell if she meant to be discreet, but the tunnel was so narrow, her voice carried to the back of the line.
"Whatever do you mean?" murmured Anthony.
"You loved it at Babel," said Letty.
"I remember you gave us our orientation tour. You adored it there, and they adored you."
"That's true," said Anthony. "Babel treated me better than anyone ever had."
"Then why?"
"She thinks it's about personal happiness," Rami interjected.
"But Letty, we've told you, it doesn't matter how happy we were personally. It's about the broader injustice."
"That's not what I meant, Rami. I only..."
"Let me try to explain," Anthony said gently. "On the eve of abolition throughout the colonies, my master decided he wanted to pack up and return to America. I wouldn't be free there, you see. He could keep me in his household and call me his. This man had labeled himself an abolitionist.
He decried the general trade for years. He just seemed to think our relationship was special. But when the proposals he'd publicly supported became law, he decided he really couldn't bear the sacrifice of losing me. So I went on the run and sought refuge at Oxford. The college took me in and hid me until I was legally declared a free man. Not because they care much about abolition either, but because the professors at Babel knew my worth. And they knew if I were sent back to America, they would lose me to Harvard or Princeton."
Robin couldn't see Letty's face in the darkness, but he could hear her breathing growing shallower. He wondered if she was about to cry again.
"There are no kind masters, Letty," Anthony continued. "It doesn't matter how lenient, how gracious, how invested in your education they make out to be. Masters are masters in the end."
"But you don't really believe that about Babel," Letty whispered.
"Do you? It's just not the same. They weren't enslaving you. I mean, Christ, you had a fellowship."
"Do you know what Equiano's master told him when he was manumitted?" Anthony asked mildly. "He told him that in a short time, he'd have slaves of his own." At last, the tunnel ended in a set of steps covered with a wooden board, sunlight streaming in through the slats. Anthony pressed his ears to the slats, waited a moment, then unlocked the board and pushed.
"Come on up."
They emerged in a sunny yard facing an old one-story brick building, half hidden behind a mass of overgrown shrubbery. They couldn't have strayed too far from the town centre. They were only 2 miles out at most. But Robin had never seen this building before. Its doors looked rusted shut, and its walls were nearly swallowed by ivy, as if someone had built this place and then abandoned it decades ago.
"Welcome to the old library."
Anthony helped them out of the tunnel.
"Durham College built this place in the 14th century as an overflow room for old books, then forgot about it when they secured funding to build a new library closer to the center of town."
"Just the old library?" asked Victoire. "No other name?"
"None that we use. A name would mark its importance, and we want it unnoticed and forgotten. Something you skim over when you see it in the records. Something easily confused for something else."
Anthony spread his palm against the rusted door, murmured something under his breath, and then pushed. The door screeched open.
"Come on in."
Like Babel, the old library was much larger on the inside than its exterior suggested. From the outside, it looked as if it could contain a single lecture hall at most. Its interior, meanwhile, could have been the ground floor of the Radcliffe Library. Wooden bookshelves radiated from the center, and more lined walls which looked magically and contradictorily, circular. All the shelves were meticulously labelled, and a long, yellowed parchment listing the classification system hung from the opposite wall. Near the front was a shelf boasting new arrivals, on which Robin recognized a few of the titles he'd snuck out for Griffin over the past few years. They'd all had their Babel serial numbers scratched out.
"We don't like their categorization system," explained Anthony.
"It only makes sense in Roman characters. But not every language is so easily Romanized, is it?"
He pointed to a mat near the door.
"Wipe your shoes off. We don't like tracking mud between the shelves. And there's a stand over there for your coats."
A rusted iron kettle hung inexplicably from the top rung of the coat stand. Robin reached towards it, curious. But Anthony said sharply,
"Leave that alone."
"Sorry. What's it for?"
"Not tea, clearly."
Anthony swung the kettle towards them to reveal the bottom, which displayed a familiar glint of silver.
"It's a security system. It whistles when someone we don't know gets near the library."
"With what match pair?"
"Wouldn't you like to know?" Anthony winked.
"We do security like Babel does. Everyone devises their own traps, and we don't tell the others how it's done. The best thing we have set up is the glamour. It keeps sound from escaping the building, which means no passerby can eavesdrop on our conversations."
"But this place is massive," said Rami.
"I mean, you're not invisible. How on earth do you stay hidden?"
"Oldest trick in the world.
We're hidden in plain sight." Anthony led them further into the library.
"When Durham went extinct in the mid-16th century and Trinity took over its property, they overlooked the supplemental library in the deed transfer. The only things listed in that library on the catalog were materials no one had used for decades, and which have more accessible duplicates in the Bodleian. So now we live on the edge of bureaucracy. Everyone who walks past knows this is a storage library, but everyone assumes it belongs to some other, poorer college. These colleges are all too rich, you see. It makes them lose track of their holdings."
"Ah, you found the undergraduates."
Figures emerged from within the shelves. Robin recognized them all. They were all former students or current graduate fellows he'd seen lurking around the tower. He supposed this shouldn't have come as a surprise. There were Vimal Srinivasan, Kathy O'Neill, and Ilse Dejima, who gave them a small wave as she approached.
"Heard you'd had a bad week."
She was much friendlier now than she'd ever been at the tower.
"Welcome to Chez Hermès."
"You're just in time for dinner."
"I didn't realize there were so many of you," said Rami. "Who else here has faked their death?"
Anthony chuckled.
"I'm the only ghost in residence at Oxford. We have a few others overseas. Vaibhav and Frederic. You might have heard of them. They faked drowning on a clipper back from Bombay, and they've been operating from India since. Lizette simply announced she was leaving for home to get married, and all the Babel faculty were too disappointed in her to follow up on her story. Obviously, Vimal, Kathy, and Ilse are still at Babel. Easier for them to siphon out resources."
"Then why'd you leave?" asked Robin.
"Someone needs to be in the old library full time. In any case, I'd got tired of the campus life, so I faked my death in Barbados, bought a passage on the next packet home, and made my way back to Oxford unnoticed."
Anthony winked at Robin.
"I thought you had me that day at the bookshop. I didn't dare leave the old library for a week. Come on, let me show you the rest."
A quick tour of the workspaces past the shelves revealed a number of ongoing projects, which Anthony introduced with pride. These included the compilation of dictionaries between regional languages.
"We lose a lot by assuming everything must first come through English.
Non-English silver match pairs. Same principle, Babel won't fund match pairs that don't translate into English, since all of its bars are for use by the British. But that's like painting with only one color, or playing only one note on a piano." And critiques of existing English translations of religious texts and literary classics.
"Well, you know my opinion on literature in general, but something has to keep Vimal occupied."
The Hermes Society was not only a hotbed of Robin Hoods, as Griffin had led Robin to believe, it was also a research center in its own right, though its projects had to be done in secret, with scant and stolen resources.
Other projects included, among others, 1. A comparative analysis of the quantity of footnotes added to translations of European texts versus non-European texts. Non-European texts, Griffin found, tended to be loaded down with an astonishing amount of explanatory context, to the effect that the text was never read as a work on its own, but always through the guided lens of the white European translator. 2. An inquiry into the silver working potential of words originating in cants and cryptolects. 3. Plans for the theft and subsequent return to Egypt of the Rosetta Stone.
What are you going to do with all this? Asked Victoire. You can't publish, surely.
We've got partners at a few other translation centres, said Vimal. We ship them work for review sometimes.
There are other translation centres? Asked Robin.
Of course, said Anthony. It's only recently that Babel achieved preeminence in linguistics and philology. It was the French who ran the show for most of the 18th century, and then the German Romanticists had their heyday for a bit. The difference now is that we have silver to spare, and they don't.
The Hermes Society also had connections with translation centers at universities in America, but these were even more repressive and dangerous than Oxford. For one, they were founded by slave owners, built and maintained with slave labor, and their endowments were sustained by the slave trade. For another, these American universities, since their founding, were preoccupied with the project of evangelizing, eradicating, and erasing natives. The Indian College, founded 1655 at Harvard University, promised free tuition and housing to native students who were required in turn to speak only in Latin and Greek, convert to Christianity, and either assimilate into white society or return to their villages to evangelize English culture and religion. A similar program at the College of William and Mary was described by their president, Lyon G. Tyler, as a prison where native children served as so many hostages for the good behavior of the rest.
They're fickle allies, though, said Vimal. They're helpful insofar as they, too, hate the British, but they've no real commitment towards global liberation. Really, all this research is just gambling on the future. We can't make good use of it yet. We haven't got the reach or the resources. So it's all we can do to produce the knowledge, write it down, and hope one day there exists a state that can put all this to proper, altruistic use. At the other end of the library, the back wall resembled the aftermath of several mortar explosions, charred and cratered across the center. Underneath, two equally charred tables stood side by side, both somehow upright despite their blackened, shriveled legs.
Right, said Anthony.
So that's our silverwork and our munitions workshop.
Did that happen over time or all at once?
Victoire asked dryly. That's entirely Griffin's fault, said Vimal. Doesn't seem to think gunpowder is an outdoor activity.
The intact portion of the back wall was covered with a massive map of the world, dotted with differently colored pins attached by strings to notes covered in dense, tiny handwriting. Robin wandered closer, curious.
That's a group project?
Kathy joined him before the map.
We add to it little by little when we get back from overseas.
Do all of these pins represent languages?
We think they do. We're trying to track the number of languages still spoken around the world, and where they're dying out. And there are a good deal of languages which are dying, you know. A great extinction event began the day Christopher Columbus set foot in the New World. Spanish, Portuguese, French, English. They've been edging out regional languages and dialects like cookie chicks. I think it's not inconceivable that one day most of the world would speak only English.
She sighed, looking up at the map.
I was born a generation too late. It's not so long ago that I might have grown up around Gaelic.
But that would destroy silverworking, said Robin, wouldn't it? It'd collapse the linguistic landscape. There would be nothing to translate. No differences to distort.
But that's the great contradiction of colonialism.
Kathy uttered this like a simple matter of fact.
It's built to destroy that which it prizes most. Come on, you two.
Anthony waved them over to a doorway,
which led to a small reading room that had been converted into a dining room.
Let's eat.
The offerings at dinner were global. A vegetable curry, a platter of boiled potatoes, a fried fish dish that tasted startlingly similar to a kind Robin had once eaten in Canton, and a flat, chewy bread that paired well with everything else. The eight of them sat around a very fine, ornamented table that looked incongruous against the plain wooden panels. There weren't enough chairs for all of them, so Anthony and Ilse had dragged over benches and sitting stools from around the library. None of the tableware matched, nor the silverware. Flames burned merrily from a fireplace in the corner, heating the room unevenly so that Robin's left side dripped sweat while his right side felt chilly. The whole scene was quintessentially collegial.
"Is it just you lot?"
Robin asked.
"What do you mean?"
asked Vimal.
"Well, you're..."
Robin gestured around the table.
"You're all very young."
"Necessarily," said Anthony. "It's dangerous business."
"But aren't there, I don't know..."
"Proper adults? Reinforcements?"
Anthony nodded.
"Some, yes. They're scattered across the globe. I don't know who they all are. Not one of us knows exhaustively who they all are, and that's intentional. There are probably even Hermes associates at Babel I'm still not aware of. Though whoever they are, I hope they start making a bit more of an effort."
"That and attrition's a problem," said Ilse. "Take Burma."
"What happened in Burma?" asked Robin. "Sterling Jones happened," Anthony said tightly, but did not elaborate. This seemed a sensitive topic. For a moment, everyone stared at their food. Robin thought of the two thieves he'd met his first night at Oxford, the young woman and the blonde-haired man, neither of whom he'd ever seen again. He did not venture to ask. He knew the answer. Attrition.
"But how do you get anything done?" asked Rami. "That is, if you don't even know who your allies are."
"Well, it's not so different from Oxford bureaucracy," Anthony said. "The university, the colleges, and the faculties never seem to agree on who's in charge of what. But they get things done, don't they?"
"Long de boeuf sauce, my dear," Kathy announced, setting a heavy pot in the center of the table. "Beef tongue and Madeira sauce."
"Kathy loves to serve tongue," Vimal informed them. "She thinks it's funny."
"She's creating a dictionary of tongues," said Anthony. "Boiled tongue, pickled tongue, dried tongue, smoked..."
"Shush!"
Kathy slid onto the bench in between them.
"Tongue's my favorite cut."
"It's the cheapest cut," said Ilse.
"It's disgusting," said Anthony.
Kathy flung a potato at him.
"Fill up on these then."
"Ah, pomme de terre en anglais."
Anthony speared a potato with his fork.
"You know why the French call boiled potatoes à l'anglaise? Because they think boiling things is boring. Kathy, just like all of English cooking, is deathly boring."
"Then don't eat them, Anthony."
"Roast them,"
Anthony persisted.
"Braise them with butter or bake them with a cheese. Just don't be so English."
Watching them, Robin felt a sharp prickle at the base of his nose. He felt the same as he had the night of the commemoration ball, dancing on the tables under the fairy lights. How magical, he thought. How impossible that a place like this could exist. A distillation of all that Babel promised. He'd felt he'd been looking for a place like this all his life, and still he'd betrayed it. To his horror, he began to cry.
"Oh, there, there."
Kathy patted him on the shoulder.
"You're safe, Robin. You're with friends."
"I'm sorry," he said miserably.
"It's all right."
Kathy did not ask him what he was apologizing for.
"You're here now. That's what matters."
Three sudden, violent raps sounded at the door. Robin flinched, dropping his fork. But none of the postgraduates looked alarmed.
"That'll be Griffin," Anthony said cheerfully. "He forgets the passcodes whenever we change them, so he beats out a rhythm instead."
"He's come too late for dinner,"
Kathy said, annoyed.
"Well, make him up a plate."
"Please?"
"Please, Kathy." Anthony stood up. "The rest of you, enter the reading room." Robin's heart hammered as he filed out of the dining room with the others.
he suddenly felt very nervous. He didn't want to see his brother. The world had turned upside down since they'd last spoken, and he was terrified of what Griffin had to say about it. Griffin strode through the door looking lean, haggard, and as travel-weary as ever. Robin scrutinized his brother as he shrugged off his ratty black coat. He seemed like an utter stranger, now that Robin knew what he had done. Each of his features told a new story. Those lean, capable hands, those sharp, darting eyes. Were those the traits of a murderer? How had he felt when he threw a silver bar at Evie Brooke, knowing full well it would rip her chest apart? Had he laughed when she died, the way he did upon seeing Robin now?
Hello, brother.
Griffin smiled his wolf smile and reached out to clasp Robin's hand.
I heard you killed dear old Pa.
It was an accident, Robin wanted to say, but the words stuck in his throat. They had never rung true before. He could not bring himself to speak them now.
Well done, said Griffin. I never thought you had it in you.
Robin had no response. He found it hard to breathe. He had the strangest urge to sock Griffin in the face. Griffin, indifferent, gestured towards the reading room.
Shall we get to work?
The task, as we see it, is to convince Parliament and the British public that it would be against their best interests to take Britain to war against China, said Antony.
The opium burning disaster has brought everything to a head, said Griffin.
Commissioner Lin has issued a proclamation banning English trade from Canton entirely. Jardine and Matheson, meanwhile, have taken those hostilities as justification for war. They're saying England must act now to defend her honour or face humiliation in the East forever. Nice way to ruffle some nationalist feathers. The House of Lords began debating a military expedition last week.
But a vote had not yet come to pass. The Lords of Parliament were still hesitant, uncertain about throwing the country's resources at such a distant and unprecedented endeavour. The issue at hand, however, was silver. Defeating China would give the British Empire access to the greatest reserve of silver in the world. Silver that would make their warships sail faster, their guns shoot further and more precisely. If Parliament did choose war, the future of the colonised world was unimaginable. Britain, flush with China's riches, could enact any number of agendas towards Africa, Asia, and South America that until now had remained pipe dreams.
We can't do anything about those plots right now, said Griffin.
And we can't think on the scale of a global revolution because it's impossible. We don't have the numbers. What we must focus on now, before we can turn to anything else, is stopping the invasion of Canton. If England wins, for she absolutely will win, there is no question, she obtains a near infinite supply of silver for the foreseeable future. If she doesn't, her silver supply dries up, and her imperial capacities shrink considerably. That's it. Everything else is inconsequential.
He wrapped the blackboard, on which names of various lords were sorted into different columns.
The House of Commons hasn't voted yet. It's still an open debate. There's a strong anti-war faction, headed by Sir James Graham, Viscount Mahon, and William Gladstone. And Gladstone's a very good man to have on our side. He hates opium more than anyone. He's got a sister who's addicted to laudanum, I think.
But there are internal politics at play too, Cathy explained.
The Melbourne Ministry is facing a political crisis at home. The Whigs have just barely survived a vote of no confidence, so now they're walking an impossible tightrope between the Conservatives and Radicals, exacerbated by the fact that they've been weakened foreign trade in Mexico, Argentina, and Arabia.
I'm sorry, said Remy.
What now?
Cathy waved her hand impatiently.
The bottom line is the Radicals and their northern constituencies need a healthy overseas trade. And the Whigs need to keep their support to counterbalance the Tories. A show of force regarding the opium crisis is precisely the way to do that. It'll be a tight vote either way, though.
Antony nodded at the board.
Our mission now, then, is to swing enough votes that the war proposals shut down.
Just to be clear, Rami said slowly, your plan right now is to become lobbyists.
Indeed, said Antony.
We'll have to convince them that war is against the best interests of their constituents. Now, that's a tricky argument to make because it affects different classes differently. Obviously, siphoning all the silver out of China will be a massive boon to anyone who's already got money. But there is also an existing movement that believes that increased silver use is the worst thing that could happen to laborers. A silver-enhanced loom puts a dozen weavers out of work. That's why they're always striking. That's a decent argument for a radical to vote no.
So you're just targeting the House of Lords? Asked Robin. Not the general public?
Good question, said Anthony. The Lords are the decision makers, yes. But a certain amount of pressure from the press and public can sway those still on the fence. The trick is how to get the average Londoner worked up over a war they're not likely to have ever heard of.
Appeal to their human nature and sympathy for the oppressed, said Letty.
said Rami.
It simply seems to me that all this aggression is quite preemptive, Letty insisted. I mean, you haven't even tried making your case to the public. Have you ever considered you might better make your point by being nice?
Nice comes from the Latin word for stupid, said Griffin.
This is true. Nice comes to us by way of the old French nice, weak, clumsy, silly, from the Latin nescius, ignorant, not knowing.
We do not want to be nice. But public opinion on China is malleable, Anthony intervened. Most Londoners oppose the opium trade to begin with, and there's quite a lot of sympathetic coverage for Commissioner Lin in the newspapers. You can get pretty far with moralists and religious conservatives in this country. The question there is how to get them sufficiently bothered about it to exert pressure on Parliament. Unpopular wars have been fought over less.
In terms of sparking public outcry, we've had one idea, said Griffin. The match pair, polemic, and the Greek root polemikos, which of course means war, said Rami.
Correct.
So you've got a war of ideas, Rami frowned. What does the match pair do?
That's a work in progress. We're still fiddling around with it.
If we can just connect that semantic warp with the right medium, we might get somewhere. But the point is, we can't achieve anything until more people understand where we're coming from. Most of the British don't understand there's a fight to be had at all. For them, this war is something imaginary, something that could only benefit them, something they don't have to look at or worry over. They don't know the cruelty involved or the continued violence it will enable. They don't know what opium does to people.
You won't get anywhere with that argument, said Robin.
Why not?
Because they don't care, said Robin. It's a war happening in a foreign land that they can't even imagine. It's too distant for them to care.
What makes you so sure of that? Asked Kathy.
Because I didn't, said Robin. I didn't, even though I'd been told time and time again how awful things were. It took witnessing it happening in person for me to realize all the abstractions were real. And even then, I tried my very hardest to look away. It's hard to accept what you don't want to see.
There was a brief silence.
Well then, Anthony said, with forced cheer. We'll have to get creative with our persuasions, won't we?
So that was the goal of the night, to shift the engines of history onto a different track. Things were not as helpless as they seemed. The Hermes Society had several plans already in motion, most including various forms of bribery and blackmail, and one including the destruction of a shipyard in Glasgow.
The vote for war hinges on Parliament's belief that it'll be easily won, Griffin explained. And technically, yes, our ships could blow Canton's navy out of the water. But they run on silver to work. A few months ago, Thomas Peacock...
Oh,
Rami made a face. Him.
Thomas Love Peacock, essayist, poet, and friend of Percy Bysshe Shelley, had also enjoyed a long career in India as an official with the East India Company. He was, in that year, the chief examiner of Indian correspondence.
Indeed. He's a rabid enthusiast of steam technology, and he put in an order for 6 iron steamboats at the shipbuilders Laird's. William Laird and Son, that is. They're based in Glasgow. These ships are more frightening than anything the waters of Asia have ever seen. They've got Congreve rockets, and their shallow draft and steam power make them more mobile than anything in the Chinese fleet. If Parliament votes yes, at least one of them is heading straight to Canton.
So I assume you're going to Glasgow, said Robin.
First thing tomorrow morning, said Griffin. It'll take 10 hours by train, but I expect Parliament will hear within the day once I'm there.
He did not elaborate on precisely what he would do in Glasgow,
though Robin did not doubt his brother was capable of demolishing an entire shipyard.
Well, that sounds much more effective, Rami said happily. Why aren't we putting all of our efforts into sabotage?
Because we're scholars, not soldiers, said Antony.
The shipyard's one thing, but we're not going to take on the entire British Navy. We've got to leverage influence where we can. Leave the violent theatrics to Griffin.
Griffin bristled.
They aren't mere theatrics. The violent hijinks, Antony amended, though Griffin bristled at that too. And let's focus on how to sway the vote in London.
So they went back to the blackboard.
A war for the fate of the world could not be won overnight. This they all knew in theory, but they could not bring themselves to stop and go to sleep. Every passing hour brought new ideas and tactics, though as the hours dragged far past midnight, their thoughts began to lose some coherence. Suppose they ensnared Lord Palmerston in a prostitution scandal by sending in Letty and Cathy to seduce him in disguise. Suppose they convinced the British public that the country China did not actually exist and was in fact an elaborate hoax by Marco Polo. At some point, they dissolved into helpless laughter as Griffin described in intricate detail a plot to kidnap Queen Victoria in the gardens of Buckingham Palace under the guise of an underground Chinese crime ring and hold her hostage in Trafalgar Square. Theirs was a harrowing and impossible mission, yes, but Robin also found a certain exhilarating pleasure in this work. This creative problem-solving, this breaking up of a momentous mission into a dozen small tasks which, combined with enormous luck and possibly divine intervention, might carry them to victory. It all reminded him of how it felt to be in the library, working on a thorny translation at 4 in the morning, laughing hysterically because they were so unbelievably tired, but somehow thrumming with energy, because it was such a thrill when a solution inevitably coalesced from their mess of scrawled notes and wild brainstorming. Defying empire, it turned out, was fun. For some reason, they kept coming back to the Polemikos match pair. Perhaps because it did in fact seem like they were fighting a war of ideas, a battle for Britain's soul. Discursive metaphors, Letty observed, revolved around war imagery rather often.
Think about it, she said. Their stance is indefensible. We must attack their weak points. We must shoot down their premises.
We do that in French too, said Victoire. Cheval de bataille.
Meaning one's favourite trope or favourite line of argument.
Warhorse, Letty said, smiling.
Well then, said Griffin, as long as we're talking about military solutions, I still think we should go with Operation Divine Fury.
What's Operation Divine Fury? Asked Rami.
Never mind, said Antony. It's a stupid name and a stupider idea.
When God saw this, he did not permit them, but smote them with blindness and confusion of speech, and rendered them as thou seest, Griffin said grandly.
This is not a quotation from the book of Genesis, which recounts the scattering of languages at Babel in much tamer terms. It is rather from the third apocalypse of Baruch, falsely attributed to the scribe Baruch ben Neriah. Griffin, in a fit of disillusionment, had briefly pursued a project recounting various versions of the fall of Babel.
Look, it's a good idea. If we could just take out the tower.
With what, Griffin?
Antony asked, exasperated.
With what army?
We don't need an army, said Griffin. They're scholars, not soldiers. You take a gun in there, wave it around and shout for a bit, and you've taken the whole tower hostage. And then you've taken the whole country hostage. Babel is the crux, Antony.
It's the source of all the Empire's power. We've only got to seize it.
Robin stared at him, alarmed. In Chinese, the phrase, Huo Yao Wei, meant literally the taste of gunpowder. Figuratively, belligerence, combativeness.
Huo Yao Wei.
His brother smelled of gunpowder. He reeked of violence.
Wait, said Letty. You want to storm the tower?
I want to occupy the tower. It wouldn't be so very difficult, Griffin shrugged. And it's a more direct solution to our problems, isn't it? I've been trying to convince these fellows, but they're too scared to pull it off.
What would you need to pull it off?
Victoire inquired.
Now that's the right question, Griffin beamed. Rope, two guns, perhaps not even that, some knives at least.
Guns? Letty repeated. Knives?
They're just for intimidation, darling. We wouldn't actually hurt anyone.
Letty reeled.
Do you honestly?
Don't worry, Kathy glared at Griffin. We've made our thoughts on this quite clear.
But think of what would happen, Griffin insisted.
What does this country do without enchanted silver? Without the people to maintain it? Steam power, gone. Perpetual lamps, gone. Building reinforcements, gone. The roads would deteriorate. The carriages would malfunction. Forget Oxford. The whole of England would fall apart in months. They'd be brought to their knees, paralyzed.
And dozens of innocent people would die, said Antony. We are not entertaining this.
Fine, Griffin sat back and folded his arms. Have it your way. Let's be lobbyists.
They adjourned at 3 a.m. Antony showed them to a sink at the back of the library where they could wash.
No tub, I'm sorry. So you'll have to soap your armpits standing up.
And then pulled a stack of quilts and pillows from a cupboard.
We only have 3 cots, he said apologetically. We don't often all spend the night here.
Ladies, why don't you follow Ilse to the reading room? And gents, you can bunk on your own between the stacks. Creates a bit of privacy.
Robin was so exhausted then that a space of hardwood between the shelves sounded wonderful. It felt as if he had been awake for one long day ever since their arrival in Oxford. That he had experienced enough for one lifetime. He accepted a quilt from Antony and made his way towards the stacks. But Griffin materialized by his side before he could settle down.
Have a moment.
You're not going to sleep?
Robin asked.
Griffin was fully dressed, buttoned up in that black overcoat.
No, I'm heading out early, said Griffin. There's no direct line to Glasgow. I'll ride into London, then take the first train in the morning. Come out to the yard with me.
Why?
Griffin patted the gun at his belt. I'm going to show you how to fire this.
Robin hugged the quilt closer to his chest.
Absolutely not.
Then you're going to watch me fire a gun, said Griffin. I think we're long overdue for a chat, don't you?
Robin sighed, set the quilt down, and followed Griffin out the door. The yard was very bright under the full moon. Griffin must have used it for shooting practice often, for Robin could see that the trees across the yard were riddled with bullet holes.
Aren't you afraid someone will hear?
This whole area is protected by the glamour, said Griffin. Very clever work. No one can see or hear much who doesn't already know we're here. Do you know anything about guns?
Not even a little bit.
Well, it's never too late to learn.
Griffin placed the gun in Robin's hands. Like silver bars, it was heavier than it looked, and very cool to the touch. There was a certain inarguable elegance to the curve of the wooden handle. How easily it fitted into his hand. Still, Robin felt a wave of revulsion as he held it. It felt mean, like the metal was trying to bite him. He wanted very much to fling it to the ground, but was afraid of accidentally setting it off.
This is a pepperbox revolver, said Griffin. Very popular with civilians. It uses a cap lock mechanism, which means it can fire when it's wet. Don't look down the barrel, you idiot. Never look straight down the barrel. Try aiming it.
I don't see the point,
said Robin.
I'm never going to fire this.
It doesn't matter that you'll fire it. It matters that someone thinks you will. You see, my colleagues in there are still holding on to this unbelievable faith in human goodness.
Griffin cocked the gun and pointed it at a birch tree across the yard.
But I'm a skeptic. I think decolonization must be a violent process.
He pulled the trigger. The blast was very loud. Robin jumped back, but Griffin was unfazed.
It's not double action, he said, adjusting the barrels. You've got to cock the hammer after each shot.
His aim was quite good. Robin squinted and saw a notch in the center of the birch that hadn't been there before.
See? A gun changes everything. It's not just about the impact. It's about what it signals.
Griffin ran his fingers over the barrel, then spun around to point the gun at Robin. Robin jumped back.
Jesus!
Scary, isn't it? Think, why is this more frightening than a knife?
Griffin did not move his arm.
It says I'm willing to kill you, and all I have to do is pull this trigger. I can kill at a distance without effort. A gun takes all the hard work out of murder and makes it elegant. It shrinks the distance between resolve and action, you see?
Have you ever shot at someone?
Robin asked.
Of course.
Did you hit them?
Griffin didn't answer the question.
You have to understand where I've been. It's not all libraries and debating theatres out there, brother. Things look different on a battlefield.
Is Babel a battlefield?
Robin asked.
Was Evie Brooke an enemy combatant?
Griffin lowered the gun.
So that's what we're hung up on.
You killed an innocent girl.
Innocent? Is that what our father told you? That I killed Evie in cold blood?
I've seen that bar, said Robin. It's in my pocket, Griffin.
Evie wasn't some innocent bystander,
Griffin sneered.
We've been trying to recruit her for months. It was tricky, see, because she and Sterling Jones were so close. But if either of them had a conscience, it was bound to be her, or so we thought. I spent months and months talking things over with her at the Twisted Root, until one night she decided she was ready. She was in. Only it was all a setup. She'd been talking to the constables and the professors the whole time, and they'd hatched this plan to catch me in the act. She was a brilliant actor, you see. She had this way of looking at you, eyes wide, nodding like you had all of her sympathy. Of course, I didn't know it was all a performance. I thought I'd made an ally. I was thrilled when she seemed to be coming around. And with everyone we lost in Burma, I felt very alone. And Evie was so clever about it. Asked all these questions, far more than you did. Made it sound like she just wanted to know because she was so thrilled to join the cause. Because she wanted to learn all the ways she could help.
And how'd you find out?
Well, she wasn't that clever. If she was smarter, she wouldn't have dropped her cover until she was safe.
But she told you.
Robin's stomach twisted.
She wanted to gloat.
She smiled at me, said Griffin. When the siren sounded, she grinned at me and told me it was all over. And so I killed her. I didn't mean to. You won't believe me, but it's the truth. I meant to frighten her. But I was angry and scared. And Evie was vicious, you know. If I'd given her an opening, I still think she might have hurt me first.
Do you really believe that?
Robin whispered.
Or is it a lie you conjure so you can sleep at night?
I sleep just fine,
Griffin sneered.
But you need your lies, don't you? Let me guess. You're telling yourself it was an accident, that you didn't mean it.
I didn't, Robin insisted. It just happened. And it wasn't on purpose. I never wanted...
Don't, said Griffin. Don't hide. Don't pretend. That's so cowardly. Say how you feel. It felt good. Admit it. The sheer power felt so good.
I'd take it all back if I could, Robin insisted.
He didn't know why it felt so important that Griffin believe him. But this seemed like the last line he had to hold. The last truth he had to maintain about his identity.
Otherwise, he didn't recognize himself.
I wish he'd lived.
You don't mean that. He deserved what he got.
He didn't deserve to die.
Our father,
Griffin said loudly,
was a cruel, selfish man who thought anyone who wasn't white and English was less than human. Our father destroyed my mother's life and let yours perish. Our father is one of the principal engineers of a war on our motherland. If he'd come back from Canton alive, Parliament wouldn't be debating right now. They'd have voted already. You've bought us days, perhaps weeks. So what if you're a killer, brother? The world's better off without the professor in it. Stop shriveling under the weight of your conscience and take the damned credit.
He turned the gun around and offered it handle first to Robin.
Take it.
I said no. You still don't understand. Impatiently, Griffin grabbed Robin's fingers and forced them around the handle.
We've moved out of the realm of ideas now, brother. We're at war.
But if this is a war, then you've lost. Still, Robin refused to take the gun. There's no way you win on the battlefield. Your ranks are what? A couple dozen, at most? And you're going to take on the entire British army?
No, but that's where you're wrong, said Griffin. The thing about violence, see, is that the Empire has a lot more to lose than we do. Violence disrupts the extractive economy. You wreak havoc on one supply line, and there's a dip in prices across the Atlantic. Their entire system of trade is high-strung and vulnerable to shocks because they've made it thus. Because their rapacious greed of capitalism is punishing. It's why slave revolts succeed. They can't fire on their own source of labor. It'd be like killing their own golden geese. But if the system is so fragile, why do we so easily accept the colonial situation? Why do we think it's inevitable? Why doesn't Man Friday ever get himself a rifle or slit Robinson Crusoe's neck in the night? The problem is that we're always living like we've lost. We're all living like you. We see their guns, their silver work, and their ships, and we think it's already over for us. We don't stop to consider how even the playing field actually might be. And we never consider what things would look like if we took the gun.
Once again, Griffin offered the gun to Robin.
Careful, it's front heavy.
This time, Robin accepted it. He aimed it experimentally at the trees. The barrel did, indeed, tip downwards. He tilted his hand up against his wrist to keep it level.
Violence shows them how much we're willing to give up, said Griffin. Violence is the only language they understand, because their system of extraction is inherently violent. Violence shocks the system, and the system cannot survive the shock. You have no idea what you're capable of, truly. You can't imagine how the world might shift unless you pull the trigger.
Griffin pointed at the middle birch.
Pull the trigger, kid.
Robin obeyed. The bang split his ears. He nearly dropped the gun. He was sure he had not aimed true. He had not been prepared for the force of the kickback, and his arm trembled from wrist to shoulder. The birch was untouched. The bullet had flown pointlessly into the dark. But he had to admit that Griffin was right. The rush of that moment, the explosion of force contained within its hands, the sheer power he could trigger with just a twitch of his finger. It felt good. Chapter 23. Oh, those white people have small hearts who can only feel for themselves. Mary Prince. The history of Mary Prince. Robin couldn't fall asleep after Griffin left for Glasgow. He sat in the dark, thrumming with nervous energy. He felt a breathless vertigo, the sensation of looking out over a steep cliff the moment before he jumped. The whole world was on the verge of some cataclysmic shift, it seemed, and he could only cling on to what was around him as they all hurtled towards the breaking point. An hour later, the old library began to stir. Just as the clock struck seven, a symphony of birdsong echoed through the stacks. The noise was too loud to be coming from outside. Rather, it sounded as if a whole flock of birds was perched invisibly among the books.
What is that?
Rami asked, rubbing his eyes.
Have you got a menagerie in a cupboard out the back?
It's coming from here. Anthony showed them a wooden grandfather clock, decorated with carved songbirds around the edges.
A gift from one of our Swedish associates,
She translated
Yukata
to Rising of Dawn, only in Swedish
Yukata
has the particular meaning of waking up early to listen to the birds sing. There's some music box mechanism inside, but the silver really imitates true birdsong. It's lovely, isn't it? Could be a little quieter, said Rami. Ours is a prototype. It's getting old. You can get these in London boutiques now, you know. They're very popular. The wealthy love them. One by one, they took their turns at washing themselves with cold water in the sink. Then they joined the girls in the reading room, around yesterday's clustered notes to resume their work. Letty looked as if she hadn't slept a wink either. She had great dark shadows under her eyes, and she hugged her arms miserably against her chest as she yawned. Are you all right? Robin asked.
It feels rather as if I'm dreaming.
She blinked around the room, her gaze unfocused. Everything's upside down. Everything's backwards. Fair enough, Robin thought. Letty was holding up rather well, all considered. He didn't know how to politely phrase what he wanted to say next, so he asked obliquely.
What do you think? About what, Robin?
She asked, exasperated.
The murder we're covering up?
The fall of the British Empire? Or the fact that we're fugitives now for the rest of our lives?
All of it, I suppose. Justice is exhausting.
She rubbed her temples. That's what I think.
Kathy brought out a steaming pot of black tea, and they held their mugs forth in gratitude.
Vimal stumbled, yawning from the bathroom towards the kitchen.
A few minutes later, the wonderful aroma of a fry-up seeped up through the reading room.
Masala eggs, he announced,
heaping scrambled eggs in a tomatoey mess onto their plates.
There's toast coming.
Vimal, Kathy groaned, I could marry you.
They wolfed down their food in fast, mechanical silence. Minutes later, the table was cleared. The dirty plates returned to the kitchenette. The front door screeched open. It was Ilse, back from the city centre with that morning's newspapers.
Any word on the debates?
Anthony asked.
They're still at loggerheads, she said. So we have some time yet. The Whigs are shaky on their numbers, and they won't hold a vote until they're confident. But we still want those pamphlets in London today or tomorrow. Get someone on the noon train. Then get them printed on Fleet Street.
Do we still know anyone in Fleet Street? Vimal asked.
Yes. Therese is still at the Standard. They go to print on Fridays. I can get in and use the machines, I'm sure, if you have something for me by tonight.
She pulled a crumpled newspaper out of her messenger bag and slid it across the table. Here's the latest from London, by the way. Thought you'd like to see it.
Robin craned his neck to read the upside-down text. Oxford professor murdered in Canton, it read. Perpetrators in conspiracy with Chinese lobbyists.
Well, he blinked. I guess that's got most of the details right.
Rami flipped the paper open.
Oh, look. It's got drawings of our faces.
That doesn't look like you, said Victoire.
No, they haven't quite captured my nose, Rami agreed.
And they've made Robin's eyes very small.
Have they printed this in Oxford too? Anthony asked Ilse.
Surprisingly, no. They've kept it all quiet.
Interesting. Well, London's still cancelled for you lot, said Anthony. They all began protesting at once, but he held up a hand. Don't be mad. It's too dangerous. We're not risking it. You're hiding out in the old library until this is over. You can't be recognized.
Neither can you, Rami retorted.
They think I'm dead. They think you're a murderer. Those are very different things. No one's printing my face in the papers.
But I want to be out there, Rami said, unhappy. I want to do something. I want to help.
You can help by not getting yourself thrown in jail. This isn't open war as much as Dear Griffin would like to pretend it is. These matters demand finesse. Anthony pointed to the blackboard. Focus on the agenda. Let's pick up where we left off. I think we tabled the issue of Lord Arsenault last night. Letty?
Letty took a long draught of her tea, closed her eyes, then seemed to pull herself together. Yes. I believe Lord Arsenault and my father are on rather good terms. I could write to him, try to set up a meeting.
You don't think your father's going to be distracted by the news that you're a murderer?
Asked Robin.
It doesn't name Letty as a perpetrator.
Victoire scanned the column.
It's only the three of us. She's not mentioned here at all. There was a brief, awkward silence.
No, that's very good for us, Anthony said smoothly. It gives us some freedom of movement. Now, you start writing to your father, Letty, and the rest of you get to your assignments. One by one, they filtered out of the reading room to carry out their designated tasks. Ilse set off to Babel to retrieve further news on developments in London. Kathy and Vimal went to the workshop to tinker with match pairs using Polemikos. Rami and Victoire were put to work writing letters to prominent radical leaders by impersonating white, middle-aged radical supporters. Robin sat with Anthony in the reading room, pulling the most damning evidence of collusion from Professor Lovell's letters as quotations for short, inflammatory pamphlets. Their hope was that such evidence might prove scandalous enough to get picked up by the London papers.
Be careful with your language, Anthony told him.
You'll want to avoid rhetoric about anti-colonialism and respecting national sovereignty. Use terms like scandal, collusion, corruption, lack of transparency, and whatnot. Cast things in terms that the average Londoner will get worked up about. And don't make it an issue of race.
You want me to translate things for white people, said Robin.
Precisely.
They worked in comfortable silence for about an hour, until Robin's hand grew too sore to continue. He sat back, cradling a mug of tea in silence, until it seemed as if Anthony had reached the end of a paragraph. Anthony, can I ask you something? Anthony put down his pen.
What's on your mind?
Do you honestly think this will work?
Robin nodded to the stack of draft pamphlets.
Winning in the realm of public opinion, I mean.
Anthony leaned back and flexed his fingers.
I see your brother's got to you.
Griffin spent last night teaching me how to use a gun, said Robin. He thinks revolution's impossible without violent insurrection. And he's quite persuasive.
Anthony thought for a while, nodding, tapping his pen against the inkwell.
Your brother likes to call me naive.
That's not what I
know. I know. I only mean to say that I'm not as soft as Griffin thinks. Let me remind you that I came to this country before they decided I could no longer be legally called a slave. I've lived most of my life in a country that is deeply confused on whether I fully count as human. Trust me, I am no jolly optimist on the ethical qualms of white Britain.
But I suppose they did come around on abolition, said Robin. Eventually.
Anthony laughed gently.
Do you think abolition was a matter of ethics? No. Abolition gained popularity because the British, after losing America, decided that India was going to be their new golden goose. But cotton, indigo, and sugar from India weren't going to dominate the market unless France could be edged out. And France would not be edged out, you see, as long as the British slave trade was making the West Indies so very profitable for them.
But nothing.
The abolitionist movement you know is a load of pomp. Rhetoric only. Pitt first raised the motion because he saw the need to cut off the slave trade to France. And Parliament got on board with the abolitionists because they were so very afraid of black insurrection in the West Indies.
So you think it's purely risk and economics?
Well, not necessarily. Your brother likes to argue that the Jamaican slave revolt, failed though it was, is what impelled the British to legislate abolition.
He's right, but only half right.
See, the revolt won British sympathy because the leaders were part of the Baptist Church. And when it failed, pro-slavery whites in Jamaica started destroying chapels and threatening missionaries. Those Baptists went back to England and drummed up support on the grounds of religion, not natural rights. My point being, abolition happened because white people found reasons to care, whether those be economic or religious. You just have to make them think they came up with the idea themselves. You can't appeal to their inner goodness.
I have never met an Englishman I trusted to do the right thing out of sympathy.
Well, said Robin,
there's Letty.
Yes, said Anthony after a pause.
I suppose there's Letty.
But she's a rare case, isn't she?
Then what's our path forward?
Asked Robin.
Then what's the point of any of this?
The point is to build a coalition, said Anthony. And it needs to include unlikely sympathizers.
We can siphon as many resources from Babel as we want, but it still won't be enough to budge such firmly entrenched levers of power as the likes of Jardine and Matheson. If we are to turn the tides of history, we need some of these men, the same men who find no issue in selling me and my kind at auction, to become our allies. We need to convince them that a global British expansion, founded on pyramids of silver, is not in their own best interest. Because their own interest is the only logic they'll listen to. Not justice, not human dignity, not the liberal freedoms they so profess to value. Profit. You may as well convince them to walk the streets naked. No, the seeds for a coalition are there. The time's ripe for a revolution in England, you know. The whole of Europe has been feverish for reforms for decades. They caught it from the French. We must simply make this a war of class instead of race. And this is, indeed, an issue of class. It seems like a debate over opium in China, but the Chinese aren't the only ones who stand to lose, are they? It's all related. The silver industrial revolution is one of the greatest drivers of inequality, pollution, and unemployment in this country. The fate of a poor family in Canton is in fact intricately tied to the fate of an out-of-work weaver from Yorkshire. Neither benefits from the expansion of empire. Both only get poorer as the companies get richer. So if they could only form an alliance... Antony waved his fingers together. But that's the problem, you see. No one's focused on how we're all connected. We only think about how we suffer individually. The poor and middle class of this country don't realize they have more in common with us than they do with Westminster. There's a Chinese idiom that catches the gist, said Robin.
Tu si hu bei.
Tu si hu bei.
The rabbit dies, and the fox grieves, for they're animals of a kind.
Precisely, said Antony.
Only we've got to convince them we're not their prey. That there is a hunter in the forest, and we're all in danger. Robin glanced down at the pamphlets. They seemed so inadequate just then. Just words, just ink scrolls on flimsy white paper. And you truly think you can convince them so?
We have to. Antony flexed his fingers once more, then picked up his pen and resumed flipping through Professor Lovell's letters.
I don't see any other way out. Robin wondered then how much of Antony's life had been spent carefully translating himself to white people. How much of his genial, affable Polish was an artful construction to fit a particular idea of a black man in white England and to afford himself maximum access within an institution like Babel. And he wondered if there would ever be a day that came when all this was unnecessary. When white people would look at him and Antony and simply listen. When their words would have worth and value because they were uttered. When they would not have to hide who they were. When they wouldn't have to go through endless distortions just to be understood. At noon, they regrouped in the reading room for lunch. Kathy and Vimal were quite excited with what they'd done with the Polemikos match pair, which, true to Griffin's predictions, caused pamphlets to fly about and continue flapping around bystanders if thrown into the air. Vimal had supplemented this with the Latin origin of the word discuss. Discutere. Could mean to scatter or to disperse. Suppose we apply both bars to a stack of printed pamphlets, he said. They'd fly all over London, wind or no. How's that for getting people's attention? Gradually, the ideas that had seemed so ridiculous last night, those chaotic scribblings of sleep-deprived minds, coalesced into a rather impressive plan of action. Antony summed up their numerous endeavours on the blackboard. Over the next few days, weeks, if necessary, the Hermes Society would try to influence the debates in any way they could. Ilse's connection on Fleet Street would soon publish a hit piece on how William Jardine, who'd stirred up all this mess in the first place, was whiling away his days at a spa town in Cheltenham. Vimal and Kathy, through several more respectable white intermediaries, would try to convince waffling Whigs that restoring good relations with China would at least keep open avenues trading legal goods, such as teas and rhubarbs. Then there were Griffin's efforts in Glasgow, as well as the pamphlets about to fly all over London. Through blackmail, lobbying, and public pressure, Antony concluded, they might make up enough votes to defeat the war motion.
This could work, Ilse said,
blinking at the blackboard as if surprised.
It could work, Vimal agreed. Bloody hell. Are you sure we can't come with you?
Rami asked. Anthony gave him a sympathetic pat on the shoulder. You've done your part. You've been very brave, all of you. But it's time to leave things to the professionals.
You've barely got 5 years on us, said Robin. How does that make you a professional?
I don't know, said Anthony. It just does.
And we're supposed to just wait without knowing anything?
Letty asked.
We can't even get the papers here.
We'll all be back after the vote, said Anthony. And we'll come back occasionally to check on you. Every other day, if you're that nervous.
But...